Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL New Hampshire Talk Radio. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and candidates on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today I'll be taking time to speak with Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, Robert Reischauer, and Charles Blahaus. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The House passed President Trump's request to cut nearly $15 billion from previously approved spending, in a vote rich with symbolism for the midterm elections. But the rescissions package is short on actual impact in terms of reducing spending and growing deficits. If it ever becomes law, the rescissions bill would reduce deficits by basically a rounding error of $1.1 billion over 10 years, according to the Congressional Budget Office, during a time when they're projected to reach $1 trillion by fiscal year 2020. Because the bill would trim about $14.7 billion from funds that the CBO has said either can no longer be spent or are no longer needed. The bill now goes to the Senate, where its prospects are up in the air, with virtually no margin for error because some moderate Republicans are already expressing concern about the bill. No matter the result, the rescissions package will not be reducing deficits anytime soon. The House is working to advance a batch of fiscal year 2019 spending bills, but they promise to be another series of partisan showdowns. Even in the, quote, minibus package, which House leaders had hoped would be the least contentious, containing the combination of the military construction VA, legislative branch, and energy water bills, they've been ridiculed by Democrats having poison pill policy riders related to environmental regulations, guns, and more. In fact, the spending package saw nearly 80 proposed amendments, 35 of which passed. The Senate is seeing a little more cooperation than the House, as it was able to advance a handful of 2019 spending bills out of committee on unanimous votes. Congress is hoping to get as many of the minibus spending packages to the president's desk by September 30th to avoid sending a large omnibus spending package that contains all 12 appropriations bills. The president has said he won't sign another last-minute, massive omnibus bill after the $1.3 trillion, 2,200-page fiscal year 2018 spending package. This is Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Up next, I will be joined on the program by Bob Bixby, Concord's executive director, Robert Reischauer, and Charles Blahaus, to discuss the Social Security Trustees' annual report that was released last week. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by some very distinguished guests, including Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby, Robert Reischauer, and Charles Blahaus. Robert's expertise focuses on the federal budget, health policy, Medicare, Social Security, and income distribution. He has been president of the Urban Institute and director of the Congressional Budget Office. And pertinent to our conversation today, he was one of two public trustees of the Social Security and Medicare Trust Funds, beginning a four-year term in 2010, and he was renominated by President Obama in 2015. He holds degrees from Harvard and Columbia, including a Ph.D. in economics. Charles' expertise includes retirement security with an emphasis on Social Security and employer-provided defined benefit pensions, as well as federal fiscal policy, entitlements, demographic change, economic stimulus, financial market regulation, and health care reform. He also served as deputy director of President Bush's National Economic Council, as a special assistant to the President for Economic Policy, and executive director of the Bipartisan President's Commission to Strengthen Social Security. Charles also was one of the two public trustees of the Social Security and Medicare Trust Funds with Robert, beginning a four-year term in 2010 and again renominated in 2015. He actually has some New Hampshire roots, serving as policy director for former U.S. Senator Judd Gregg, and has degrees from University of California at Berkeley and Princeton, including a Ph.D. Thank you all for joining the show, Bob, Robert, and Charles.
Thanks for having us.
Welcome.
The Medicare, Social Security and Medicare Trustees report came out last week. You both did a preview of what to expect in that particular report, and I'd like to kick off the program by talking a little bit about the role of the trustees. So I wonder, maybe Robert, Chuck, if you guys could explain a little bit the different types of trustees and then your role as a public trustee and what that looked like.
There are four trustees who are in their positions as ex officio members of the administration: the Secretary of Treasury, the Secretary of Labor, Secretary of HHS, and the Commissioner of the Social Security Administration. There then, since 1983, have been two individuals from the public, one from each party, which serve for fixed four-year terms, can be renominated, or if there haven't been replacements selected, they serve a fifth year. These are presidential appointees that are confirmed by the Senate. Let me just turn to Chuck, who can explain what the different responsibilities are of these two sets of trustees.
Well, sure. As Bob, I know him as Bob, but Robert, I'll say here, outlined, the public trustee positions were established in the 1983 Social Security reforms. That was done pursuant to the recommendation of the Greenspan Commission, and the idea was to further public confidence in the objectivity of the projections. There were some additional duties that were mentioned with respect to ensuring the integrity of the investment procedure, the investment of the trust funds in the Treasury securities of the general fund. But over the years, there has been something of a traditional, informal, but pretty widely respected role of the public trustees, which is that they generally work together as kind of an independent bipartisan team, overseeing the projections in an independent bipartisan way. And traditionally, the public trustees, have had the lead role with respect to explaining the trustees' projections before Congress, in testimony before Congress, and explaining them to the public. Within the trustees' process, they also play an important role as well. Obviously, the Secretary of the Treasury, Social Security Commissioner, these other government officials have a lot of other important duties, and so rolling up their sleeves and spending hour after hour fly-specking the particulars of the methodology and the assumptions is just not really practicable. So there's a natural process by which the public trustees work together with the staff of the cabinet secretaries on the projections, and then the cabinet secretary trustees generally tend to be brought into the process sort of just intermittently throughout the year to oversee the work that everybody else is doing.
Robert and Chuck, you both served as the public trustees, and if I'm remembering correctly, we don't currently have any public trustees serving in that role at the moment. So I guess thank you for continuing your service as a private citizen here. I wonder if you could share a little bit about your preview, perhaps what some of the specific things to look for were and whether the actual reports address those questions.
Well, we did a preview which basically said here are the salient features to watch for in every report. Now, there are certain metrics, certain projections that appear in every report, and we also said there's a set of particular assumptions that might be worth watching in this particular report because there have been changes in the legislative environment, changes in the economic environment. There's always changes in the demographic environment as well, although sometimes we don't know what those are until we see the trustees report come out. And so we basically pointed to those in the preview. I think with respect to the actuality of the report and how it compares to the preview, I think it conforms to our expectations in the sense that there's a certain story that tends to remain largely the same every year. There's a certain qualitative shape to the curves on the Social Security side that's not really going to change that much over the long term from one year's projections the next. So the story is pretty much the same each year, except a little bit worse. Social Security has a very substantial financing shortfall, and every year that we have a trustees report, the trustees confirm that. It becomes a little bit more certain. It becomes a little bit more urgent. And perhaps most importantly, our options for dealing with it become more constrained because you have another cohort of baby boomers already collecting benefits. And generally speaking, Congress doesn't like to go back and alter the benefit formulas for people already collecting. So the story that we expected and the story that we got was that the shortfall was becoming a more urgent situation, and Congress is running out of good options for dealing with it. Now, there were, I think, some surprises in this year's report. In our preview, we did not point to, nor do I think did we privately expect, some of the adjustments that we saw. There was a very substantial adjustment to the incoming payroll tax revenues for both Social Security and Medicare. It was a retrospective adjustment to the data for 2016 and 2017, and it resulted in a much lower expected payroll tax collection number for 2018. And this meant that both Social Security and Medicare's Hospital Insurance Trust Fund are beginning the drawdown of their trust fund reserves in 2018. Last year's report, that was not expected to happen until 2022 in Social Security and 2023 in Medicare hospital insurance. So that was new. That was a surprise. It's concerning, and it's also not something that we had previewed in our prior publication.
One question I had was, I know there's been talk of trust funds and exhaustion dates. For Social Security in the report, did the trustees indicate whether the point of exhaustion of the Social Security trust funds, was that bumped up at all? Is it about the same? What does it even mean?
What it means is that, according to the latest trustees report, that the date at which the Social Security combined trust fund is exhausted is 2034, which is the same year as was projected last year. So while there was a little change, there were actually two Social Security trust funds, one related to disability insurance and the other to old age and survivors insurance. What happened is that the disability insurance fund looked like it has a few more years of before exhaustion than was thought last year, and Social Security has basically stayed the same, moved a few months, but the combined trust funds, which is what most policymakers look at, has remained unchanged.
Robert, this is Bob. I want to talk a little bit about specifically what happens when the trust funds become insolvent and the advantages of acting sooner rather than later. In fact, it's the trustees are always urging lawmakers, so far unsuccessfully, to address the program earlier, presumably because things can be phased in. But if one were to wait until the exhaustion date, what would that look like? And what's the difference between the amount of changes that you'd have to make if you made them now on the tax and spending side versus waiting until you get up until the point where the trust funds are exhausted?
Okay, let me start by just pointing out that under current law, benefits and administrative costs have to be paid for out of the trust fund into which the payroll tax revenues are channeled, and certain income tax receipts on Social Security benefits are channeled. Right now, as Chuck has pointed out, we're beginning to draw down that trust fund for Social Security. When it becomes exhausted, then all benefits and administrative costs have to be reduced to the amount flowing in to the system through payroll taxes and these very modest income tax receipts. At that point, if we waited until we were reliant only on payroll taxes, we would have to cut across the board all benefits by 23% if we were to say, well, let's make up the difference with a higher payroll tax. the payroll tax would go from 12.4%, which is where it is now, half borne by employers and half by employees, and it would have to rise up to 16.27%. Now, these are humongous changes, and if you think of something like cutting all benefits for all beneficiaries by 23%, that would devastate the lifestyles of a very substantial portion of the retired and disabled population. Something like half of the recipients of Social Security right now depend on Social Security for more than half of their incomes, and 19% rely on Social Security benefits for over 90% of their benefits. So this is really a huge impact on them. We, of course, would like to start an adjustment sooner so it could be more gradual, both gradual if we were increasing payroll taxes or cutting benefits. And if we started today cutting benefits so that the system would be in balance over the next 75 years, we would have to be cutting benefits by 17% as opposed to 23%, which would be the impact if we waited until the date of depletion. As we have pointed out in our writings, the Congress and policymakers generally have tried to protect existing beneficiaries, people who are already receiving Social Security or are eligible to receive it, from benefit cuts because they can't really respond in any way by going back to work or whatever. And if we sort of started today and said, let's cut the benefits such that we could balance this over the next 75 years, we would be cutting all new beneficiaries by 21%.
This is Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. I'm speaking with Bob Bixby, Robert Reichauer, and Charles Blahaus. And Bob, I know you wanted to jump in right there, but I have this question burning within me. When was the last time this system was significantly reformed, and how do we get to a point where we can make some of those obviously tough choices that are necessary, as you just outlined, to get us to a point of sustainability?
Well, the last time we had major financing reforms in Social Security was 1983. That was a very significant event. You had the system really came to the brink of failure. The benefit checks were literally a couple of months away from not going out. And there was almost a political failure to rescue the system from insolvency. It was very, very difficult. There were several sort of half-hearted and failed attempts, and so finally there was kind of a Hail Mary pass thrown very late in the process. And there was a deal brokered between certain members of the Greenspan Commission staff representing the Reagan White House, and other people representing Tip O'Neill, and other key players in that rescue were Senator Moynihan, Senator Dole. But the point is that it was very difficult, almost didn't happen. You had both parties had to work together in a way that was politically very difficult. You had the AARP fighting the rescue. So, again, that added to the political difficulties of people on both sides of the aisle as they came together to solve it. We already have a shortfall now that is much, much bigger than the one that they faced then. It's over 50% larger if you don't adjust for the changes in the actuarial methods of the trustees over the years. If you adjust for that, it's closer to twice as large now. And the closer we get to the doomsday date, the more the current shortfall gets larger and the more difficult it becomes to correct it. So by the time the insolvency date moves near, we're looking at something that's three or four times as difficult to do as what they did in 1983. And Robert laid out the numbers on how ugly they are, and I think, you know, they're illustrations of where we would be legally and substantively at that point. But I think from a practical perspective, the real story is that the shortfall would just be so large that it just wouldn't be possible to close that gap. And that would mean there would have to be very dramatic changes made to Social Security's financing structure in order to enable it to continue, because it just seems very unlikely that we're going to suddenly reduce people's benefits by 23% or suddenly jack the payroll tax up from 12.5% to 16.5%. Those things just aren't going to happen, which means that Congress will not be able to align the program's benefit and tax schedules within the payroll tax financing structure, and they would have to turn to a very different kind of financing structure, probably one that is subsidized to a very large extent from the general fund in order to keep the system going.
Chuck, this is Bob Bixby. Before we leave Social Security, I did, and this follows from your last point, is that while we think of it as a self-contained system, it does have an impact on the federal budget when it is either running a surplus or running a deficit. Now it's running a deficit on a cash basis. And I think sometimes people overlook that. So the scenario that you were talking about, it's not just a matter of the Social Security system, but if it's running larger and larger cash deficits, that has an impact on the federal budget. Isn't that correct?
That is correct. When Social Security runs a surplus, takes in more revenue than the benefit and administrative costs are, it uses that surplus to invest in government securities, and that's what builds up this trust fund larger and larger. And as has been pointed out in the discussion previously, that seems to have come to an end right now, and the Social Security Trust Fund will be, in a sense, redeeming its bonds from the federal government. The federal government will, to pay for those redemptions, will have to go out and borrow money from the general public. That will increase our unified budget deficits, which already are very large and are projected to reach over $1 trillion a year in the not-too-distant future.
We are unfortunately running out of time in this segment. This is Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman, and I will be joined in the next segment by Bob Bixby, Bob Reichauer, and Chuck Blahaus as we take a closer look at the Medicare side of the trustees' reports that came out last week. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm again joined on the show by Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, Bob Reichauer, and Chuck Blahaus. As I mentioned in the earlier segment, Bob and Chuck are both former public trustees of the Social Security and Medicare Trust Funds. Thank you for continuing the conversation with us today.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
So we discussed the Social Security Trust Fund and the report in the earlier segment. I wanted to turn our attention to Medicare now. And why don't we sort of kick off this segment how we did last and touch on what your preview had to say about the Medicare program and what the trustees report talked about and whether those two matched up. And Robert, we'll start with you.
Okay. Like the Social Security trustees report, the big surprise in the Medicare one was that the hospital insurance fund, which is where the trust fund issues are, is beginning to draw down the resources in its trust fund. And what that means is that the trust fund is expected to be depleted sooner than was assumed in the last report. It was assumed in last year's report that the trust fund would last until 2029, and now it appears that the trust fund will be exhausted in 2026, which, you know, is only 8 years away and makes the issue sort of much more critical that we face up to the challenges that trust fund is facing and do something about it. We have a political system which has shown its ability to procrastinate and not sort of face the difficult decisions that have to be made, the ones that are politically costly to make, until the very last moment. But in this case, as well as in the Social Security case, the sooner we make these decisions, the less wrenching the adjustments will have to be made when the trust fund actually runs out of money. With respect to the trust fund in Medicare, the situation will be that payments to providers would have to be cut by 9% if we waited until the date of exhaustion to make our cuts. They would then grow rather steadily up to 22% by the mid-2040s. So this is a problem that only gets worse over time.
And Chuck, maybe you could jump in here real quick and maybe go back to the basics for us and help our listeners understand how the Medicare system works, especially when it comes to those trust funds. And I know there's different parts of Medicare, so it seems to be a little bit more complicated than the setup for Social Security.
Medicare has two trust funds. It has a hospital insurance trust fund. It has a supplementary medical insurance trust fund. The hospital insurance trust fund is probably easier for listeners to understand if they're familiar with how Social Security works. It's a similar financing principle. The hospital insurance trust fund is funded primarily by payroll taxes, and as with Social Security, each year the trustees are looking at it to make a determination as to whether its finances are going to be adequate going forward or whether it faces the projected depletion of its trust fund reserves as it does and as Social Security does. With supplementary medical insurance, it's different. You have basically, it is kept solvent by statutory construction. Roughly a quarter of its revenues come from premiums that are paid by or on behalf of participants in various ways. The other three quarters comes from payments from the government's general fund, and all of this is automatically adjusted each year to grow to be sufficient to finance those years' benefit payments. And so that side of Medicare is not subject to these annual projections from the trustees of potential insolvency. Now, that does not mean, of course, that that side of Medicare does not exhibit financing strains. It absolutely does. But those financing strains are manifested in different ways. They're basically manifested in growing pressure on the general federal budget, and more and more of that cost is basically facing taxpayers and premium-paying beneficiaries. One final point I'd make is that hospital insurance in Medicare and disability insurance in Social Security are looking at somewhat different flows than, say, the old age or what people think of as the retirement portion of Social Security. The retirement portion of Social Security has a very large trust fund built up, and so there is more of its future financial outlook that is determined by the drawdown of the balance of that trust fund, at least in comparison with its annual operations, the annual tax collections and outflow. That's still the vast majority of the picture, but there is a substantial part of the picture that comes from drawing down the trust fund. With respect to Medicare hospital insurance, though, and disability insurance, those two trust funds have very small balances. I mean, hospital insurance has about 8 months' worth of benefits in it. Disability insurance has about 6 months' worth of benefits in it, which means that very little of the financing outlook in those programs has anything to do with the trust fund balances at all. It's almost entirely incoming and outgoing annual flows. And so if there is a significant change or even not a very big change in those annual flows, those depletion dates can move around a lot, and they do move around a lot. So it's something to be wary of. You could have a sudden change in the depletion dates for hospital insurance or even disability insurance of several years in either direction at any time.
In fact, Chuck, my follow-up question there was, how has that date changed for depletion for Medicare with this particular trustee's report?
Well, it got worse. It got worse by 3 years. And again, with both Social Security and Medicare, there was a retrospective revision in the share of our economy that is filtering through to the program's tax bases, basically the amount of taxable payroll that there is out there for Medicare, hospital insurance, and Social Security to draw upon. That's lower than we thought it was, or lower than the trustees thought it was. And so both of those programs are looking at lower payroll tax collections in the near term, and that is, again, having a bigger effect on Medicare hospital insurance because its trust fund was so small to begin with. And on top of that, you had a couple of other nudges in the wrong direction for Medicare hospital insurance. You had higher than expected expenditures over the last year. You had a couple of other minor nudges in the wrong direction from legislation over the last year with a slight reduction in its payroll tax revenue, revenue from the taxation of Social Security benefits, and the repeal of the Independent Payment Advisory Board and some of the other things that were done over the last year. None of these things are big, but it doesn't take a very big change to cause things to move by a few years in the wrong direction.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking with Bob Reichauer and Chuck Blahouse, as well as Bob Bixby, who hasn't gotten a question in edgewise yet. So, Bob, let's switch over to you. I'm sure you're itching to ask questions here.
My sympathies for any trustees that have to look at the projections of Medicare, because you have to deal with assumptions about what's going to happen with underlying health care costs as well. And as everyone knows, that can be kind of an uncertain proposition. And in fact, the Office of the Chief Actuary of Medicare produces an alternative scenario where some of these longer-term projections, not so much in the near term, but longer-term projections can get much worse. And I don't want to really get into the weeds on this, but the Office of the Chief Actuary does say that their purpose in producing this so-called alternative scenario is to stimulate discussion among policymakers and analysts. When I read this, it's like, well, the Medicare outlook looks pretty bad, but the actuaries are actually telling us that they think that the official numbers are probably unrealistically optimistic.
Well, and in part that is because we have gone through a period in which healthcare spending has slowed down, the growth of healthcare spending, and we've instituted a lot of reforms both in the private sector and in the government sector in the hopes of moderating future growth, but it's far too early to assume that these are going to be significantly successful. So as Bob Bixby has pointed out, there's huge uncertainty about the future with respect to healthcare that involve both policy and medical science, that new things are being developed, new drugs are coming online that could prove to be very beneficial for some conditions, but also cost hundreds of thousands of dollars a year.
The financial challenges facing the two programs it's similar, but it's different. It's sooner on the Medicare hospital insurance side, but it's a lot bigger on the Social Security side. That's where the bigger actuarial deficit is. So if the question is, what are we going to do about this? We can have a discussion about a very fulsome set of relatively severe changes that would have to be made to get Social Security back into actuarial balance. But with Medicare hospital insurance, although it's a sooner problem, its actuarial shortfall is much less than Social Security's. And why is that? Well, it's largely because there were very aggressive payment reductions enacted in the Affordable Care Act. And if those hold, then the size of the hole that we have to fill on the Medicare side is a lot smaller than it is on Social Security. So getting back to this alternative scenario that you outlined before, what that illustrates is that if these payment reductions don't hold, we've got a much, much bigger problem on the Medicare side to fill. So yes, it's important to have a discussion about what Medicare reforms to institute from this point forward, but a very large part of that story is whether these payment reductions hold, and it's very strongly in our interest that they do so, because without them, we've got a much, much bigger problem in Medicare than we're currently projecting.
And speaking of those payment reductions holding, what's going on in Congress right now that might make matters better or worse moving forward for Medicare?
Well, I think the big issue here is what will happen to the Affordable Care Act and the repercussions of that. The assumptions were in 2010, when it was adopted, that there would be a slowdown as a result of the various reforms and the inclusion of uninsured people into a larger insurance program that would slow down overall medical inflation and cost growth. And to the extent that those are undone and we don't substitute some at least equally effective measures, Medicare will be under extreme pressure to raise its payment rates. As Chuck has pointed out, much of the slowdown in Medicare costs over the next 50, 75 years is associated with these reductions in payment rates, that with an even faster growth of underlying medical costs in the private sector will not be able to be sustained by government programs.
And this is obviously a midterm election year, and we're fast approaching 2020. There's already candidates seemingly campaigning. Do you think, and I'm going to cross over to both topics here, do you think the issues that Social Security and Medicare are facing will be topics of conversation for these candidates? What kind of call to action might you give to incoming potential leaders that are running for office right now?
Well, I mean, I'll leap in on that and immolate myself, and Dr. Reischauer can join in if he wants. But I would say that the basic political story is that as the problem has become more severe, more urgent, more real, our political discussion has become increasingly disconnected from reality. Back in the late 1990s, when these problems were not yet as urgent as they are now, we actually saw more people willing to talk about them. Now that we're much closer to the crunch date, and the measures required are much more severe than they were then, you actually have more people running for office denying that these, or just evading discussions of these problems at all. Now, at some point, the roof has to cave in on that. I don't see any signs of that happening this election, but ultimately reality is going to become so urgent that it's not going to be feasible for elected officials to have this stance of denial, but I'm not sure we're there yet.
I agree with that completely. I think it used to be said that Social Security was the third rail of American politics, and then there seemed to be a rest period in which people were talking about ways to reform the system without paying a huge political price for it. I think that period has largely come to an end, and it is so easy to demagogue any solution that is put forward. And so you get people saying, well, let's solve the Social Security problem simply by eliminating the taxable earning cap on Social Security and tax all those people who are above that cap on all of their income. Or in the Medicare situation, let's just cut payment levels to hospitals and other large institutional providers that are doing nothing but building new atriums and making fancy single-room hospital beds, absorb it that way. There are a lot of things which, a lot of, quote, solutions that sound simple, but they're either impractical or wouldn't generate the kind of resources needed to put these two programs back in financial sustainable situation.
Chuck mentioned that years ago people seemed to be more interested in talking about the problem, even though it was further away. It was 20 years ago this summer, I think Bob and Chuck will recall, that the Concord Coalition and AARP were joining in an effort at the behest of the Clinton administration called the Great Social Security Debate, in which we were trying to get bipartisan dialogues around the country that President Clinton agreed to attend on a couple of occasions, and we get high-level Republicans to do it as well. And it certainly got a lot of attention, but was derailed for reasons that had nothing to do with Social Security and more with political problems at the end of the Clinton administration. But I certainly feel, in talking to folks on the Hill and just other people that deal with Social Security policy, that there certainly was that time when everybody had some sort of plan, and now it seems that the most popular plan is the do-nothing plan, even as the problem has gotten worse.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and unfortunately, we are out of time. I feel like we could spend a whole another hour talking about these subjects. You've been listening to me, Bob Bixby, Bob Reischauer, and Chuck Blahaus discuss the Medicare Trustees Report and the future of the program. Thank you all for joining the show, Bob, and Chuck.
Thank you, Chase.
Thanks, everybody.
We'll be back after these short messages for our final segment, Facing the Facts. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and this is our final segment, Facing the Facts, where I share with you a fact or piece of information that I think is worth you pondering until next week's show. So, it's time to face this fact. Accounting for the Social Security and Medicare trust funds obscures the fiscal problems each of these programs are facing. Every year, the trustees of Social Security and Medicare issue detailed reports on the financial status of these programs. In fact, as we discussed on today's show, the latest reports were just released. While the trustees' reports consistently warn that both programs face serious shortfalls, the urgency of this warning is often undercut by undue attention to the years in which the Social Security Trust Funds and Medical Hospital Insurance, or HI Trust Fund, are projected to become insolvent. In the 2017 report, these years were 2034 for Social Security and 2029 for Medicare HI. In the 2018 report, Medicare HI is now projected to be insolvent by 2026. There is a natural tendency for people to look at these projections and conclude that no action is needed for several years. However, the trust funds are a misleading indicator of the program's fiscal health and the extent to which they impact the federal budget. Trust fund solvency says nothing about fiscal sustainability because government trust funds are primarily an accounting device. If dedicated revenue for a program is greater than its spending, the extra, quote, savings is not deposited into a traditional trust fund that gathers interest from external borrowers. Instead, the excess revenue is used to finance the rest of government spending, and the program in surplus gets an IOU from the government. These IOUs are treated like trust funds, but they really just represent the federal government borrowing from itself. An important thing to keep in mind, these Treasury IOUs can only be redeemed if Congress raises taxes, cuts other spending, or borrows from the public. Thus, their existence alone doesn't ease the burden of paying future benefits. They just signify that the government owes itself a lot of money. Trust fund accounting obscures the timing and magnitude of the program's fiscal shortfalls because it implies that there are resources being held in reserve or real assets that can be drawn down on in the future to pay benefits. However, real assets are not created by giving the trust fund an IOU and promising to sell the IOU to the public when the money is needed to pay benefits. Even if the trust fund IOUs will no doubt be honored, the real issue is how the government and society will afford them. The annual difference between a program's outlays and dedicated tax revenues matters far more than the balance of its trust fund. Social Security has been paying out more than it takes in since 2010. Cashing in some of its Treasury IOUs to pay benefits and adding to overall federal budget deficits. Because there are no actual savings in this trust fund, Social Security's annual deficits have been and will continue to be added to the government's already large deficits. Between 2017 and 2034, Social Security deficits are projected to total over $3 trillion. Discussions of trust funds are even more misleading with the Medicare program. The Medicare HI Trust Fund only covers Part A of Medicare and receives its income from the dedicated Medicare payroll tax. However, the other parts of Medicare fall under its Supplementary Medical Insurance, or SMI, which receives about 25% of its income from beneficiary premium payments, while the remainder is covered by automatic payments taken from general revenues. No one pays attention to the solvency of SMI, which is larger and growing faster than HI, because its automatic payments from the Treasury make it permanently solvent. This infusion into SMI amounts to hundreds of billions of dollars in spending each year, not accounted for when the focus is solely on HI or the trust fund. Leaving SMI out of the equation gives a very distorted picture of both the immediate budgetary impact of Medicare and its long-term prognosis. Focusing on trust fund solvency may seem reassuring, but it conceals the fact that Social Security and Medicare are already drawing on growing infusions of general government revenue simply to pay for benefits. Waiting for trust fund insolvency to address the strains of an aging population that are already materializing would turn this problem into a crisis. And each year Congress waits to engage in reform, makes realistic changes to improve the sustainability of Social Security and Medicare more difficult and painful. You have been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.